From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
All the women just want to hug Charlie, get their photo, so you wouldn't want to be a jealous wife.
I'm trying to place your accent because you're from Rathfarnham, but I mean, I'm picking up bits of Mayo and the Midlands and all over the place.
To be honest, right, I get asked that every day. What I say to people that it's an All-Ireland accent, right, to keep everyone happy.
The amount of coffee cups disposed in Ireland every hour is 22,000.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily. Have you had it yet? The people who are managing to avoid COVID. The amazing All-Ireland accent of Bonner O'Leinchig. And why we should ban lawnmowers. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that rewilds previously tame audio. Well, that's what it says here. The shock news today is that we can't begin Friday's Playback Daily with the musings on the news. The newsings, if you will, from the Ryan Tuberty show this morning, as we usually do, because, well, there was none. No newsings, that is, not no Ryan Tuberty show. Instead, Ryan read out a lot, and I mean a lot, of texts from people organising events for Saturday's Climb with Charlie fundraiser. Indeed, the whole Ryan Tuberty show was devoted to the fundraising initiative. After reading an exhausting number of texts from people around the country organising their own fundraising events, Ryan spoke to Claire Bird about Saturday's main event on Croagh-Patrick.
We are now down in Westport. We came here yesterday, so there's fierce excitement down here. Last stages of planning.
I was going to say, so you arrived down, yourself and Charlie, what sort of greeting did you get?
Well, wherever we go, all the women just want to hug Charlie, get their photo, so you wouldn't want to be a jealous wife. So, yeah, no, amazing. Everyone here loves Charlie, I swear to God. Yeah. Absolutely. And Tiger.
Of course, Tiger.
And then I'm behind, way behind down the line.
You're third in that pecking order.
Third in that pecking order, yeah.
You're the third bird.
tell me this.
How's Charlie doing this morning?
It's doing great. You know, in fairness, myself and Charlie, like, you know, obviously we've been going through all our own challenges, etc. But since we've came down here, we're just getting stuck into, you know, the climb for tomorrow. Like, today's Friday, we've got 24 hours, and we've been putting on the gear. So, it's been amazing, Ryan. I mean, we have, as you know, Daniel singing at the top of Croagh-Patrick. We have the Clew Bay Pipe Band, who have never played at the top of Croagh-Patrick.
Really?
The Army Corps, Air Corps are coming in today, and they're going to chopper up all their instruments, bring them to the top of Croagh-Patrick. So I'm definitely going down to see that. And it's just that excitement. And also Midwest Radio are going to broadcast live from the top of Croagh-Patrick. They've never done that before.
Wow.
So the Army are going to chop up their Jenny and their speakers.
Great.
So when we're at the top, Charlie will be able to use his app and the whole of Croagh-Patrick, and people can hear Charlie speak. So, no, it's brilliant. And the weather is stunning. Like, I'm looking out the window going, oh my God, the skies are blue down here. So, yeah.
That sounds good. And what are they saying about the weather for tomorrow morning, 25 hours from now?
I'm actually afraid to look.
I know.
I have the rain gear. And I mean this, myself and Bird have done no training. We spent the last, 9 weeks trying to, you know, pull all this together. Like, we have a priest down here and an inspector who are looking after us.
Okay.
By Kilness Gully, and they are the crack. So we just haven't had time to do any walking. So, yeah.
Well,
I think Daniel's singing will bring me to the top.
You'll be elevated by the dulcet tones of Mr. O'Donnell.
I've actually asked him. He said to me, what kind of song
would
Charlie like? And I said, well, we love Bruce Springsteen. So, I think he's going to crack into Bruce at the top of Croagh-Patrick.
I am now in my head doing Daniel O'Donnell's version of Born in the USA. Exactly. I'll do it for you tomorrow when we're on the hill. But
we'll sing all the way up.
All the way up. Well, we went for a walk, yourself, myself, and John, and Charlie, and Tiger, just after Christmas. Exactly. What was the name of that hill? I keep forgetting the name of the day.
Sleave Carrick.
Right.
Sleave Carrick.
It was gorgeous. It was a beautiful day. Yeah. It was really that lovely December morn with the sun and all the rest of it. But I got, I didn't think when we were doing that climb, I just can't believe how big this is and how many.
Oh no, it's massive.
Like, Claire, I'm looking at the text coming in, the emails coming in here. I mean, there's no part of the country hasn't been moved by this story.
I know, yeah.
And they really, people really want, and it's in some ways, people just want to give. People want to do something. People want to
do something good.
This is it. And
yeah.
Also motor neuron disease, also, you know, neural diseases, generally speaking. And then, of course, Pieta and how many people are affected by that, particularly in the last 2 years, mental health. This is these are two organisations that will are hopefully at the moment you're touching, what, nearly a million?
We're nearly a million.
Before foot has hit the mountain.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's remarkable.
Unbelievable. Yeah, it is remarkable. And I mean, a million was kind of our target. And I said to her, you know, it's just, it's like it's just going to get bigger and bigger. People just want to keep giving, and it's like we've over 200 climbs, and people are climbing all around the world, and people have taken on our messaging of don't just come to Crowpatrick, climb your mountains in all your own areas, climb your own hills, your stairs, light your candles, and it's really worked. And like we have a team of volunteers, and some of my best friends have been working on this with me. They said they'd work for a week, and 9 weeks later, they're still working.
Yeah.
And they have been fantastic, Ryan. And without the messaging to get people, you know, to climb their own mountains and, you know, just support us, it's been unreal. I mean, Dun Stores came on board, and they are doing a whole, like, for 4 days. They started yesterday. You can donate at their tills. And they're going to compete that in every single branch in the whole of Ireland. Dun Stores, you can go in and you can donate the till if you want. So like everyone's come on board, and like local people down here have been amazing. Like McGing's taxi company, they're just giving their services for free.
Good.
I know everybody, they're just, people have been fantastic. Like we're down here in Hotel Westport, and it's like being at home here.
Right,
like, I'm in behind the reception desk having the crack with the ladies. Like they're brilliant. They're just
make
so lovely.
Yourself at home there, Claire.
I actually feel Mary from reception, our like best mate.
Mary and Claire hanging out at reception. You know, just
you meet Mary. She's lovely.
I'm already looking forward to meeting Mary.
Yeah. So they're just brilliant down here. So like the whole day, like the weather's fabulous. So the Helliers can take off today and get to the top of Crowpatrick with everything we want. So,
and you got the you felt the love from Vicky Phelan, lovely message from her as well. Yeah, she's
amazing. Yeah. And her parents actually are going to come down with her siblings, and they're going to climb with us. So I mean, really special. I know Vicky wants to, you know, be here, and you know, she's just an amazing, inspirational woman. So
there's going to be a lot of love on that mountain tomorrow. A lot of love.
There will be. Yeah. I know, and all my friends and my mother, Bert's mother-in-law, is coming down.
Thank goodness for that.
Thank goodness. And all, obviously, Bert's daughters, Orla and Nessa, and the grandkids, who I think you might be chatting to tomorrow.
Yeah.
They're all coming down, so we're very excited to see them all. It's going to be brilliant.
I noticed that Charlie was saying during the week that he's been crying a lot. Is he okay in that regard? He said it's kind of part of his MND's diagnosis.
You know, it's part of it. I mean, but there, a lot of them are tears of joy. Like people are so kind to him, and you know, when people are kind to you, it's just becomes very, very. Yeah, it's moving. It's overwhelming, and people are lovely, like lovely to him. And part of motor neuron, you do either have outbursts of laughter or outbursts of tears.
Okay.
And so you do have that. But with this going on, everybody, their kindness to Bert, it just, he cries, and it's such a lovely side to him, because it's who he is, and he's so grateful to everybody just coming out to support him. And he loves everyone, and he loves meeting people. And I think it's going to take a long time to get up Crowpatrick, because he has time for everyone, because he just appreciates that everybody's out here to do something good.
What an event. I mean, it's going to be great.
Claire Bird talking to Ryan from Westport prior to Saturday's Climb with Charlie fundraiser in aid of the Irish Motor Neuron Disease Association and Pieta. Have you had it yet? While some people have been hit with COVID more than once, others have managed to avoid it altogether. On this morning's Today with Claire Byrne, reporter Brian O'Connell spoke to people in Cork about how they've escaped contracting the virus.
All I did was just kind of stuck to myself and kept the distance and used the sanitizer and the mask.
We're outside at the moment. I know you have the mask around your chin.
Only going indoors.
Yeah.
Only going indoors.
Or you could have had it and you mightn't have any symptoms.
Symptoms or nothing. No.
And would you usually get a cold or a flu most years?
Very seldom. A lot of my family got it.
And you still avoided it?
I did, yeah.
Even people in the house?
I'm not going into crowds. It's just luck, I suppose.
You didn't get COVID?
No, I didn't, no. I obviously was careful as much as I could, but I wasn't paranoid, if I can say that,
And did people in your family get COVID?
No, none of us, no.
None of you?
No. At some point I was actually kind of, anxious that I didn't get it, you know. I'm not wearing masks inside anymore.
I mean, people can be careful and still get it.
Of course, yeah.
It's just...
Yeah. You know, it's like any other virus that can get it, you know, yeah. at any time, you know.
Maybe I got it and I was asymptomatic, but I was testing negative.
Would you still be as mindful as you were a while
Absolutely.
Back? You would, yeah?
100%. Yeah. More so than ever. And I think people should use their own initiative and be mindful of everybody else, as we've all been. I just feel because you're being told that you don't have to wear a mask doesn't mean you shouldn't wear one. When people have got it, they're like, well, I have it, and it's kind of a bit of a, I'd not necessarily say a selfish act, but they know that they're not going to get sick. I was with people that had it in close contact with them because they didn't realise at the time that they had it. I never got it off them. But everybody's got a different story on it. You know, there's no one rule with it, unfortunately, so I think it's just being mindful and careful of what you do and where you go.
Brian O'Connell talking to people in Cork on Today with Clare Byrne this morning. So why is it that some people have avoided getting the seemingly unavoidable virus? Clare put that question to Cliona O'Farrelly, Professor of Comparative Immunology and Biochemistry at Trinity College Dublin.
This is something that has been interesting me for a long time. Many of your listeners will probably know the hepatitis C story. Do you want me to mention that?
Yes, do, of course.
Yeah, yeah. So many years ago, rhesus negative women got contaminated anti-D, contaminated with hepatitis C virus, and it was a real tragedy. And I was studying liver immunology at the time, and I was really interested in why some women who got the contaminated anti-D did not become infected. And so we set up a study to look at that and have been doing that for about the last 5 or 7 years, and you can ask me about what we found.
And did you get any answers on that?
Well, it's taken a long, long time to really to set it up, to collect the people and to get the data. But we do have data now that the women who were resistant to, who did not become infected, have a more effective innate immune response. So that's the immune response that kicks in immediately on encountering the virus. And it's the part of the immune system that's right at the site of where the virus is. So along the epithelium of the nasopharyngeal tract in the case of SARS. I then became really interested in why some people might be resistant to SARS-CoV-2. So that's another study.
The innate immune system that manages to push this back, that's not a lifestyle thing. That's just there.
Well, we should make it clear that a whole lot of people are not becoming infected because they're being super careful. And, you know, they're to be congratulated and certainly for that to be continued, like some of your Vox Pop people were saying. Mm-hmm. But in addition to the people who are not getting it because they're very, very careful, there are those whose innate immune system, or that's what we believe, and that's what we're studying, whose innate immune system is able to keep the virus away without becoming infected at all.
And is it a push now to ask you why that might be the case?
Of course. If we can get the answer to that, we're part of a huge international consortium that's trying to address the same thing with people from about 40 different countries who are pooling volunteers who fit these very strict criteria. We're looking for people who have, ideally, who have resisted the virus twice. Who in the first wave before vaccination and more recently with the Omicron. And ideally, we need people who have whose partner was PCR positive while they shared a room with them, and they remained PCR negative. So they're quite strict criteria, selection criteria.
They certainly are, but there are people out there, and I know because, I mean, you hear it anecdotally around the place.
Yes.
You just look at them and go, why have you managed to not get this virus?
Yes, yes. So back to your question about the reason, there'll probably be several reasons why, and certainly genetics is going to tell us that there'll be some people, you've probably heard of some of the studies which have shown that people who have very severe response to infection have changes in some of their immune genes. So there's a genetic kind of marker of severity of infection. So this consortium is looking for genetic markers of resistance to infection. So it means having to sequence the whole genome of the people who are resistant, and then looking amongst, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack, because the human genome is so hugely variable. But we're anticipating that we'll see some mutations in some of the innate immune genes that give people resistance.
And just going back to what you were saying about hepatitis C, did you find when you were looking at this innate immune response in that instance that it was very rare?
We found actually that more women did not get infected than we expected. Like, at that, people think that hepatitis C is very infectious if you get the contaminated blood. But in fact, quite a few women received the contaminated blood but did not become infected. So we think it's not completely rare. It's probably, you know, but we have no idea, Claire. Mm-hmm. This is, again, the big, one of the other big questions, because obviously it changes how we think about, you know, getting population protection if we know what proportion of people is actually resistant to the virus.
Yeah, all the people now who've never had it are getting in touch with us as we're speaking. Caroline is in Clonmel. She minds her grandchildren, drops and collects at three different schools. Two of my grandchildren had COVID. I'm constantly in their company. I have never had it. It's amazing, says Caroline.
Yes.
And it is,
she
really.
She may well be somebody. She may well be somebody. So I don't know how to avoid being inundated, but people should look at our website, Viral Resistance Project, and then decide whether they'd like to just Google Viral Resistance Project and you'll see it. And we talk in it, I think we mentioned in it about the hepatitis C, because we had used that website to recruit the resistant anti-G people as well. So it's an ongoing kind of question in our group, is how the innate immune system is able to keep viral infection away.
Well, if it could be replicated, it would be a great thing, because if some people were immune to it, that would have a huge impact on the fight against COVID.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you'd be able to, and also, you see, again, a question people, once we start talking about it, a question, I know some of your listeners will be wondering this. If you're resistant to one virus, will you be resistant to others? And indeed, the anti-D women were asking me that. And both the hepatitis C virus and SARS-CoV-2 are RNA viruses. So it may well be that a person who's resistant to HCV might be resistant to SARS-CoV-2. But flu is a totally different type of virus. And, you know, many viruses come from very different families. And just because you're resistant to one does not necessarily mean you're resistant to the other. Mm-hmm. But this is what we would be wanting to research. You know, once you got your resistant people, then you could get stem cells and make epithelial cells and make a model and look to see were they resistant to various types of viruses.
Cliona O'Farrelly, Professor of Comparative Immunology and Biochemistry, Trinity College, telling Claire Byrne why some people have failed to get COVID. With climate change getting ever more perilous, not to mention the monetary cost of energy reaching stratospheric heights, there have been some suggestions, most notably from former Green politician Saoirse McHugh, that we should stop mowing our lawns. Indeed, some have gone so far as to suggest that we should ban lawnmowers. On this afternoon's Live Line, Katie Hannan, sitting in for Joe Duffy, spoke to first Helen about whether or not we should ban lawn mowing and all its evil works.
I don't really believe we should ban lawn mowing. I grew a circle of grass last year about the size of a large trampoline in the back garden, and it was beautiful. But by May, the grass was flowering and my son couldn't step outside the back door without forcefully sneezing continuously. So I had to cut it down because the table we sit at in the garden is near to where the patch of grass was. So, you know, and it was lovely. It was really beautiful, but we can't do it.
And why did you do it in the first place?
Well, we actually had planted a circle of daffodils where the trampoline was, and we didn't want to cut the daffodils down, you know, before the leaves had died back.
Right. So you thought.
And then the grass looked so lovely, we kind of just let it keep going.
And so you thought you'd have this wild patch, this wild grass area.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you said the allergies, the pollen came and got you.
For him, it did. Yeah, not the rest of us. But we had no inkling that would happen. We'd never, you know, any time we'd walked in the countryside, we hadn't had him sneezing all over the place, you know.
And as a general idea, do you think it is a good idea that we rethink our approach to lawns?
Yes, I do. I mean, I definitely think we should be looking at solar-powered batteries for lawnmowers and that sort of thing. I suppose maybe we need to be educated in how to desensitize ourselves if we are allergic, if it's possible, you know, through natural products to support us being in nature, because we are part of nature. So, but I don't like it when anybody says ban. You know, it doesn't seem right.
Yeah, banning generally is, I suppose, a fairly extreme approach to it. But from what I hear, what you're saying is that you're sympathetic to the idea that we need to think again about how we approach our gardens.
Absolutely.
And did you know, I mean, your son, you said, had these allergies blew up. You weren't, was he not aware of that? Did he not have issues previously to this?
No, I mean, the odd time when he might have cut the grass, you know, mowed the lawn, he might have sneezed a little bit, but nothing that persisted. But this was so immediate and forceful when he stepped outside the back door that I had to respond. You know, I don't know. I mean, had we said, you know, live with this for a few weeks, see what happens, I don't know how it might have been for him. But I mean, once those mucous membranes get inflamed, they can be pretty difficult to get down, can't they? Because you keep rubbing eyes, nose, and, you know, it's awful.
Well, I know, yeah, people who do suffer from hay fever and allergies like that really do go through torture at this time of year. And, like, would you stand out in your neighbourhood if you decided to let the grass, the lawn grow wild? Like, do your neighbours all mow their lawns?
Yes, I think so, in general, yes.
I'm just wondering how much of it is social pressure in terms of how people approach this, because, you know, you might say you're doing it for the right reasons, and I've seen, you know, I'm leaving this for the bees signs and some you know, overgrown lawns. But, you know, I think there's some neighbourhoods where that might not be appreciated.
I suppose so. I mean, we don't have any grass at the front. We've got plants in gravel. So, you know, I suppose the front lawns, I don't see particular pride in front lawns. I don't see them being neglected either. And I don't really know what's happening in the back garden.
Helen, thank you for that. I want to bring in Frances now. Frances, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
This issue of whether or not it's, you know, environmentally kind, or the way to go to keep these manicured lawns. Where would you stand on that, Frances?
Yeah, I feel that we need to allow the lawn mowing debate to be a debate and leave individuals decide. Like the lady that just spoke, you know, she tried, but for other reasons, it wasn't possible. That wasn't defeat. That was somebody trying to be there for the environment and biodiversity, you know, because some people have really, really big lawns and they're very difficult to manage if they leave them grow wild. But people should be maybe encouraged with a planting grant or something to plant their lawn areas so that they don't have to cut them, if that's how they feel. I just feel, and again, like the other lady, I feel very strongly about what next? You know, do we ban painting our houses because the paint is toxic for the environment? Do we ban tarmacking our roads because the tarmacadam is toxic? You know, we need to kind of almost draw a fine line and leave individuals, you know, we're educated people, you know, and leave individuals decide.
What about the idea of levies? Because obviously I often look back and cite the plastic bag levy as a hugely successful levy in terms of encouraging a change in behaviour and a massive cut down on the amount of plastic bags that are in use now. And of course, we have the proposal this week, or the plan this week, to introduce a levy on coffee cups, disposable coffee cups. Would you support that?
Yes, I would support the level on the coffee cups, because the amount of coffee cups disposed in Ireland every hour is 22,000.
From lawn mowing to coffee drinking, the effects of climate change, and our half-hearted efforts to tackle it, as discussed on this afternoon's Liveline. Back on the Ryan Tuberty Show, our host returned by phone to Westport, where he spoke to Sharon McGrail, a teacher in Skulfoldsrig, right around the corner from where Claire Bird was talking to Ryan earlier.
And your students and the pupils, what are you, our primary school?
Yes, we're a primary school. We're the main primary school here in town. We have over 350 pupils.
Oh, yeah.
And we have children from over 38 different countries here with us.
Have you really?
Yeah, we do.
You're like a United Nations with chalk.
Yeah. A mini pubble.
Well, yeah. I mean, nobody has chalk anymore, but you know what I'm trying to say.
I know, yeah.
And how are the children this morning? Are they well?
Oh, they're excellent and they're very excited because we've been very lucky here, Ryan.
Come on.
Last January, when you launched your Climate Charlie campaign with Charlie, we were very lucky because we have a lovely teacher here in school, Nicole Gannon,
mm-hmm.
and she teaches sixth class, and she also plays with the Clew Bay Pipe Band.
Oh.
So on a Thursday evening in January, we became aware that she was going up to your show to play with the band.
Yes.
And we just thought, wow, wouldn't it be lovely to send a message to Charlie? So we acted very quickly on the Friday morning. I met our principal here, Mr. Shoiga, and Mr. Shoiga sees Sharon McGrail coming walking fast. He knows she has a plan.
A woman on a mission.
So, yeah, and he just lets us off. So he very kindly said, yeah, go ahead. So we decided, how are we going to connect with Charlie at a distance? So we're looking up at Kilpatrick here every day, and we're, you know, conscious of the big mountain that it is for you, everyone, to climb tomorrow, and we're also aware of Charlie's own personal journey. So we said, right, we'll do some footprints, because we knew that he has been training since January, and we all the children at the school started to make their own little footprints, and I went around to the classes and explained who Charlie was and a little bit of his story and his journey, and it became very clear, Ryan, that they got it very quickly, mm-hmm. and they very carefully decorated the footprints and decorated them so beautifully, and we put them together with a letter, and we told Charlie that we were going to be walking with him in spirit. So we have a daily mile route around our school here, and we pledged to Charlie in the letter that we would walk the daily mile every day from January 17th until today is our last mile.
Wow, well, that is so impressive.
So we have now clocked up over 2,000 miles because, of course, we were very lucky then. Charlie was very moved when he got our footprints, and he still has them as a profile on Twitter, which we're very touched by. And he came to visit us with Claire and Tiger.
Oh, he sent me footage of that visit. I now know who you're talking about. And he was, that was a beautiful occasion.
I've heard Claire there this morning speak about the tears of joy. Well, there were lots of tears of joy that morning.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
All the children out, and they were so excited. They chanted his name, and it was just beautiful. And then the sixth class children with Miss Gannon and Mr. McCrone, they wrote a song for him. And we took the Proclaimers 5,000 Miles song and we adapted it to our school motto, which is Arayla Kiela, going forward together. And they performed it for Charlie.
Let's take a little clip of that. I love this.
When you start climbing, we know what you're going to be. You're going to be a role model to us all. Arayla Kiela, going forward, going forward.
And on a lovely piece of music and a bit of Gaelic.
It's become an anthem. Yeah.
Oh, I bet.
And it was really special. And I suppose that was the day that we fell in love with Claire and Charlie and Tiger that day. And I think they might have fallen in love with us a little bit too, because they came back and visited us a second time in March, just the three of them. And it was really special. And the children have gained a huge appreciation, I suppose, about life, really, through this, Ryan. You know, I suppose we talk about the hidden curriculum at school and how much of it is taught and not taught. But this journey for us, we have, you know, we've taught children so much about doing the right thing and standing up for people and including people. And, you know, we feel very privileged to have shared this journey with them today. And we're looking forward to meeting them one last time uptown in Westport today and hopefully singing that song one more time.
Yeah, I've no doubt. And hopefully I'll meet you all and if you're there tomorrow, I'd love to meet you guys. Because it's, you know what, it's very moving the way you describe it, that for children to see this story. And you can interpret it and you can teach it. This is why you're so good at your job there, obviously, in so many ways. You'll get more out of this story than any book will tell a child.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because actions speak louder than words.
It's physical. It's emotional.
Yeah.
There's so many life lessons in this story. And it's also the beautiful ecology and the nature of this beautiful mountain, the symbolism of it. And Charlie, and then telling them about illness and life and love and loss and everything. It's a massive lesson for these children, this generation of kids.
It is huge. And I think, you know, even when he came to visit us the second time, he brought some pictures from his travels to the North Pole and the South Pole. And he spoke to them that day about climate change. And, you know, I think our children have a very good school ethos here anyway, but I think this has strengthened it. And the moral compass of Scolfóric is very strong as a result. And I think they will, you know, they will grow with this project into the future, I think.
It sounds like everybody has been enriched by Charlie's story.
Absolutely,
So far.
They're such special people.
Sharon McGrail, a teacher in Scolfóric Westport, talking to Ryan about Charlie and Claire Bird and the fundraising efforts of her school. Abood Al-Jamali came to Ireland from Baghdad and started hurling for Ballinteer St John's in Rathfarnham, County Dublin. Abood is a diversity and inclusion advocate and is also known as Bonner O'Linshig. He spoke to Claire Byrne this morning.
I'm really interested in your nickname, Bonner O'Linshig. Where did that come from?
Well, the name Bonner came while I was training in November under 16s and I play wing forward, and what happened was the ball was kind of going out the line, and I kind of flicked the ball, right? And one of the lads shouted Bonner, and it came from Bonner Mair, who played for Tip, and it turns out obviously Bonner Mair has done that in a game, and the next week, I come down to training, and everyone's calling me Bonner, you know. And then I just said, you know what, I like it. I was like, I gotta stay at that, lads. So you know, that's how. Bonner came.
And you were in school, you arrived from Baghdad in 2008, I know. You were in school and you were watching the lads going on to train after school at 2:30. After a couple of weeks then you decided to join them.
That's true, yeah. Well, it was you know, seeing a couple of boys like obviously going down to train, and I seen the game of hurling being played beforehand anyway, but you know, on TG Cahir when I was sitting down in the living room, but it just did not appeal to me, you know. And obviously when I seen them boys going out to train, I was like, you know what, I might as well give it a try. And so I done so, and then after that a couple of lads obviously hurled with Ballinteer St John's, and they said, look, we've training on later on at 7 o'clock. And I was like, sure, look, I'll go on and see what the crack is. And I went down there and I obviously got introduced to it there.
Were you any good at it in the beginning?
I was useless. I was absolutely useless, you know. I remember getting put on last 5 minutes as full forward, right? And a ball comes down from the halfback line, drops straight in front of the goalie. And I was literally trying to pull on it, right? I was about a minute trying to pull on the ball, right? Everyone's just there looking at me. I look at the sideline, the coaches just have a face spam. I was like, oh, Jesus Christ, that's embarrassing. So, that kind of gave motivation for me is to actually go out and just stick at it, you know, and not make a show of myself next time.
I'm trying to place your accent because you're from Rathfarnham, but I mean, I'm picking up bits of Mayo and the Midlands and all over the place.
To be honest, right, I get asked that every day. And what I say to people that it's an All Ireland accent, right, to keep everyone happy. you know, so it's from all the 32 counties in Ireland.
Well, it's a great so, one. It's a great one.
Thank you very much.
You're doing appreciate some diversity and inclusion work with the Dublin GAA sponsors AIG, and that has taken you to the mosque on the South Circular Road in Dublin. Now, what were you telling them about the GAA?
Yeah, no. You know, it was actually a very, very interesting one. It was the first roadshow of the AIG Dublin GAA DE&I Effort is Equal initiative. And I kind of, you know, I wanted to introduce GAA to minorities here in Dublin. I do that all over Ireland. In Dublin there, I done that with, I started off with South Circular Road Mosque before Ramadan starts, you know, which is tomorrow. And look, I was actually expecting 60 children, you know, to attend. And it was, you know, in collaboration with Kevin's Harlan and St. James Gales. And it turns out over 100 children, you know, showed up with their parents. Like, so it was a really, really, you know, great enthusiasm and very, very good excitement, like, you know. Mm-hmm. And I kind of started off by sharing my story, saying, look, the GAA is this. It's almost like a fun history kind of lesson, right? Because not a lot of people, obviously, of minorities would know what GAA is or what even GAA stands for. So I kind of started, obviously, saying, look, that's what GAA is. That's what it has done to me. You know, that's what the benefits are. And then kind of introduce them to the basic skills of the Gaelic Games. And it was very, very much perceived by everyone. Like, very, very much perceived, really, really good, you know, by everyone there, the parents, the local community there. Everyone loved it, like. But, yeah, and that's kind of, like, I remember this one little girl, 11 years of age, when she was playing camogie, she goes, that's the funnest day of my life, like, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, Jesus, that's great, like.
You know, and Abud, we've been hearing a lot about GAA clubs around the country on the television programme. We had Bray Emmett on, and they were saying the way they have these open days now on a Sunday, and they invite Ukrainian children in, and really it just gives them a bit of respite from the stress of what they've been through. And I know you'd hope that lots of other clubs around the country would do that if they're not already doing it.
Yeah, look, I feel it's important, like, you know, anyone that's, you know, if people coming in to Ireland of different backgrounds or fleeing war, that it's important to start nice and early and put the foundations in. And for me, that was GAA. And that's kind of what I, you know, what I advocate for is that when people do come into this country, that we do approach them in a way that is, you know, I suppose, in a respectful manner, and that's convenient to that culture or that country that they're coming from. So, for example, the Ukrainians coming into Ireland who are fleeing war, it's important, let's say, not to talk about news or not to talk about war when they're here because they're fleeing it. Sure, why would we, you know, talk about it? Like, but
talk about sport instead and having a bit
exactly.
of fun.
Exactly. Talk about sport instead and have a bit of fun. And obviously, it's an interest of integration too. So, yeah, that's really
okay.
what it is.
You mentioned there Ramadan starts tonight. You'll observe it, but you'll keep playing, will you?
I will. I will certainly keep playing it. Championship starts in late April, so I can't afford to miss any training sessions. Do you know?
Is it tough when you're fasting to play?
Look, it's. I've been doing it since I was 5 years of age. You know, I started off in Baghdad, but obviously, you get used to it at the end of the day. But sure, here in the summertime, it's tough. All right, like because obviously you don't have to, you can't drink water, and you can't eat any kind of food. And if you have a match on at 6 o'clock in the middle of July, and you get and you're playing wing forward, where a lot of you know, and you get it in a lot of 50-50 balls, you know, you'd need a couple of, water into you. But your luck.
You get through it anyway.
That's Abdul Al-Jamali, a.k.a. Bonner O'Linechig, and his amazing All-Ireland accent, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about diversity and inclusion in the GAA. Experimental archaeologist, and who knew there was such a thing as experimental archaeology, Dr. Brendan O'Neill joined Ray Darcy this afternoon to talk about some medieval items made by his students that he brought into studio with him.
Now, I've never met an experimental archaeologist before. I've met archaeologists. So what's the difference?
We're a rare breed. So I suppose in my career, I've got two hats. I'm an archaeologist on one side. So I look at early medieval kind of crafty stuff, metalworking and ceramic production, like pots, clay pots and stuff like that. And on the other hand, I'm an experimental archaeologist. And that's kind of looking at materials, things, thinking about production, but not just kind of looking at them and trying to understand the archaeology, but also trying to bring together the materials to test what we do practically. So the easiest way I can describe
okay,
it is
go on.
Archaeologists dig a pot up out of the ground, but that's a clay pot, and we're not allowed to cook in it or to use it in any way, obviously, because it's a precious artifact. So what we do is we spend our time analysing it, understanding what it's made from, how to make it again, the techniques, and then we can then make it
a replica
and use it.
All right.
So we can begin to understand, like, well, how did people like use it in their fireplace
wow.
in the medieval period or the Bronze Age or whatever, that kind of thing.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's a bit fun.
So you're living as they lived. What
kind
better,
of,
what better way to understand their lives?
Yeah, it gets into a mindset. Like, we can never go back to,
no,
the, to these
not.
Periods,
yeah.
but, you know, it gets us into a mindset. But as well, it lets us test some of the things that we think about things. So, like, archaeologists say that was made like this, this was used like that, but it can never be tested. We can't go back and look at it, right? So when we come in, we know kind of how to test things. We come in then and we go, okay, well, can it be made like that? Can it be used like that? And then we can... I'd say we add to the narrative rather than like disprove it or anything like that.
And what sort of dragged you this direction as opposed to just archaeology?
Yeah. Well, I was always really interested in artefacts. So, like, you know, you can be a digger or a surveyor or different types of archaeology. I was always very interested in artefacts. And then when I was doing my undergrad, there was always these questions, but we don't know how it was made, or this is very complicated to make. There was that kind of distance between what people did in the past and then kind of us, you know, nearly we couldn't make a bronze tool
and yet
or whatever.
We can fly a man to the moon.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I just always felt like that was something they did a while ago. We don't do it anymore.
Right,
okay. So I just got interested, and then I was a perfect combination of par and board when I was an undergrad. So I used to go out into forests and like collect stones to make stone tools, and wood to put a handle on the stone tool, and then kind of just progressed from there into clay, pottery, metal, all that kind of stuff.
And you've been given, is it an acre of land up in UCD?
Yeah, it's about an acre, yeah.
Now, I must declare interest here in that I run around it every morning. So it's a fenced off, and you're doing bigger stuff than artefacts. There's a couple of dwellings there, is there?
Yeah. So we've got the Centre for Experimental Archaeology Material Culture, which is a bit of a mouthful, but we just call it CMAC. And it's an enclosed space that we can run experiments in. And that's kind of, it's like unique within a university set. And you might get this in a heritage park or in some universities, you might have to, you know, you get a loan of land for a day and you go out to a farm somewhere 10 kilometres away. But this is on campus, so we can do things, monitoring them the whole time. And yeah, we do things from this morning. I was out with a class and we were making early medieval kind of penannular brooches, kind of, you know, the brooch with the pin, hold up your cloak. We were making them this morning as part of a class to get us thinking about that kind of craft.
So the cloak went across and then you fastened the brooch there, and you have one, you
this
have it
kind
there.
Of, this kind of bronze brooch here, so kind of this loopy bit goes through, and then it's a small,
what did
small
you call
brooch,
it?
A penannular brooch. Annular means round, penannular, round with a break.
Right.
Simple.
Penannular brooch.
So these are kind of the more evolved version. It's like the more advanced version is the Tara brooch.
Yes,
you know, that's a pseudo penannular brooch, but it's in the same.
But that one isn't decorative. It's functional.
It's functional. And but the metal and these little tiny glimmers of decoration here on it. And these are the class are replicating a brooch from a mould that we found on a site in Donegal, like in the 40s or something like that.
Talk me through the process then. You have the finished product here. Here's one I made earlier. So what have you done? How do you get there?
So the easiest way I can do is tell you about the class.
Yeah.
It's called Practical Experimental Archaeology, the master's class. And I showed them the mould that's in the National Museum. You can go into the little treasury room, the anti-treasury. There's a little brooch mould there, and you can see just a hint of the brooch, just the negative impression of it. We showed them that picture and we say, you're going to make the brooch. That's the class.
Right, and they go,
the brooch doesn't exist, you're going to make it. But you're only allowed to use early medieval technology, so that's kind of 400 to 1100 AD, only early medieval technology, and you have to have evidence for everything. So it's a research tool. You have to get really into the archaeology of it, you've got to understand. So we have to make the metal from a stone like this.
Where'd you get the stone?
This one here, we just kind of buy in.
Oh, you buy in.
We don't get it because it's from archaeological sites now.
Okay, yes,
but like Ross Island, Copper Coast down in Waterford,
okay,
these would be places where you get it in the early medieval period.
That's sort of the red stone, is it?
This one's a nice green one. The iron would typically be a reddish
stone, that kind of stuff.
And then they have to make the metal, and then bronze, which this
is made
from.
So how do they get the metal out of the rock?
It's very, very tricky. So you have to create a furnace, so like a hot thing that has the right temperature of above 800-900 degrees, but also it has to have no oxygen, low carbon. But these are all things people are figuring out, like from the Bronze Age on. Right. You know, they sound complicated when I tell you about it, but when I show you it, it's essentially a mucky pit in the ground with some bellows going into it, some charcoal, smash up the stone, put it in, bellow, and metal comes out.
Right.
But the chemical reactions are really, really complex.
They didn't understand those, though.
No, but they had just a different way of viewing them. They're still a really complicated, sophisticated way of understanding them, but not a kind of a, there are atoms and...
Yeah, periodic table.
We're not pulling apart stuff like this. But once you've made your metal, you need a crucible, a little clay pot to melt the metal in. You need a mould to pour the metal into.
Yes.
Like, all this stuff has to be made by the students.
Brilliant.
And then you need something to heat it up in, another type of furnace, and that's what they were doing today. Melting the metal, pouring it into the mould to try and knock it open and take out the wee brooch. And that's just a way for us to begin to think about craft, to think about we find a brooch mould. It's not a very nice thing. It's not a fancy thing. It's not a tower brooch. But again, it has its own complexity, its own story.
You see, like I was thinking about this today when I knew you were coming in. And I often think like this, when we look at, a baby, say I was a baby once, as were you. Mm. And now look at us grown men with all the knowledge we have and the things that we can do.
Yeah.
And if you think about the human race like that. Mm. So this bit of whatever making a brooch in some way has contributed to this this phone, this
Absolutely.
Mini computer that we have in our pocket.
Yeah.
So it's an amalgamation of all the knowledge over the years, building up.
The one I like to talk about, so when we see in the Bronze Age, you're making tools out of bronze and things, like things that we wear, objects of adornment, we call them. So like nice, blingy things as well. But when we get into the early medieval period, you've got iron for tools, and it's like it's brooches. It's only really blingy things, or Ardagh chalice, church stuff. So it's things for display.
Yeah.
And while that might seem weird, another way of look, like I wear a wedding ring.
Yeah.
So these are non-ferrous metals. We call them like non-iron metals. So we wear non-ferrous metals as jewellery. Like we have earrings, we have chains, we have this. But this communicates something about me socially. Somebody sees that, instantly they know I'm married.
Yeah.
So again, it's the same in the past. These things are communicating, social things. So while this is maybe a functional brooch, it's also telling something about my status, my gender, my ethnicity, all these different things, subtle little things that are built into it.
UCD experimental archaeologist Dr. Brendan O'Neill talking about, what it is an experimental archaeologist does on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show. Meanwhile, the Ryan Tuberty Show continued its focus on Saturday's Climb with Charlie fundraiser, with Ryan talking briefly to personal trainer Carl Henry about the best ways to approach climbing Croagh-Patrick or indeed anywhere else.
Carl, people all around the country seem to be climbing some class of hill or reek or mountain tomorrow. What do we need? Give us the top bits of advice.
Yeah, so first of all, so the key thing is you've got to build it to your fitness level. So make sure that you're fit enough to do what you're trying to do. That company you're chatting about earlier on, doing 134s for Mount Fuji, I hope they've had their full medicals before they attempt that, because it's a fairly big thing to attempt.
Okay.
So just ensure that you're fit enough to do it. And if you're not, don't be afraid to turn around. And that's really, really important. From what I know, we'll be chatting to Joanna Donnelly later on. The weather forecast for tomorrow is cold, but a couple of showers and a bit of sunshine. So prepare for all weather. Bring a rucksack, bring some warm stuff in the rucksack, some gloves, a hat. In terms of clothing, it's layering, right? So it's a non-cotton-based T-shirt. That's really important because the cotton stuff fills with sweat and gets really cold. Then a light fleece on top of that, and then a rain or windproof jacket on top of that. Nothing new tomorrow. So don't get the shiny new boots out because you're going to get blisters. Use gear that you've worn and trained in over the course of the last couple of months. And that's really, really important. Because otherwise it's going to make it very uncomfortable no matter where you're climbing it, and that is crucial. Always bring some Vaseline just in your rucksack in case you need it, in case you get blisters. And then obviously lots of food is important too. If you're going to climb somewhere new that you haven't done before, bring your phone with you, ring someone if you're with a small group, let them know where you're going, be safety conscious. That's really, really important. We've had loads of questions on Instagram. I am going to do an Instagram live when I'm down in Westport. So if you have any questions or any of your listeners have questions, follow me on Instagram and I'll be able to do a live.
When are you doing the live?
I'll do it later on this evening when I get to Westport. So it's at Carl Henry PT because we're getting so many questions in from people with regards to what they should do. Bring some food with you. So water and food are really important. Bring the sandwiches, bring some fruit, bring a pack of something like jelly babies or fruit pastilles or something. The sugar in that can be really good.
Now you have my undivided attention.
I know.
Jelly babies, you say. I'll bring a big pack of jelly babies tomorrow.
Because just in case you feel a bit, you're getting a bit tired.
Sugar hit.
You get a lovely kick from that. And it is important. I know I have a rucksack full of sugary stuff for yourself, Baz and Dermot, and everyone else coming to
good man, Carl.
Don't worry.
That's personal trainer Carl Henry pulling into the side of the road to give Ryan Tuberty and the rest of us some practical tips about Saturday's Climb with Charlie fundraiser on Croke Patrick or anywhere else climbing events are happening. Finally on Playback Daily, Chef Shane Smith joined Claire Byrne this morning with another hero food. This time the heroic ingredient is lemons.
It's just one of those, I suppose it's my third seasoning in a way. It's one of those ingredients that I always kind of reach for in the kitchen. Again, it's just one of those things that I always have loads of. So as we're saying, it's just so versatile in regards to starters, mains, desserts, drinks, you name it. You can kind of throw a bit of lemon into everything.
And like people will associate lemons with fish ultimately when you're talking about a seasoning. But you're saying today you should look a lot further than that.
Yeah, I think that's the generic. I think people always look at your smoked salmon and your little bit of lemon juice and something in there. But again, there's just a world of different recipes out there that you can try out with lemon. So even you start on even starters there, like lovely baba ganoush recipe, which is a lovely dip, which is basically like a lovely roast aubergine with lemon juice and lemon zest in there. And it's a beautiful kind of little starter, family sharing style. It's a nice little lemony, fresh way to start off a meal. And even preserved lemons is something that...
Explain preserved lemons to me. That's a mystery to me now. What are they? What are they used for?
So basically, I suppose the origin would have been kind of North Africa kind of area. And basically, it's just a way of again, preserving the fruit. So what you basically do is you're kind of using unwaxed lemons. And I'll explain that later on. But you basically just quarter your lemons, not whole, as in fully, because you want them to hold their shape. And you fill the center of them just with salt, good quality salt. And you put those into a jar. You leave them in a sealed kind of kilner jar for about maybe 4 weeks or so until the juice comes out of the lemons and they kind of ferment naturally and have a little bit of sweetness to them. And then you can use that in a range of different recipes. It's got that lovely kind of salty lemon flavor that you can add into a gorgeous kind of Moroccan olive tomato chicken dish. It's also really good if you add that into rice or couscous, just to add that extra little layer of flavor. And again, it's something that keeps really well.
Ah, so it's another dimension. Now, you've mentioned your recipe for baba ganoush, and all of your recipes will be up on our website today, all using lemon in different ways. Talk to me now, Shane, about the difference between using the zest, which some recipes call for, and the juice.
Yeah, I personally would say, I'm a pastry chef, so I kind of focus more on the baking. I personally think that you get a much better payoff in flavor when you use the lemon zest. So again, the juice is really good if you're making like a drizzle cake, or again, if you are using that in a dish, like a starter or a savory dish. But I find payoff for flavor, the zest for me works a little bit better. You need to be careful too, because if you're adding lemon juice to like a dairy based, either a dish or a curry that you're finishing off with yogurt, that can split that on you. So you just need to keep that in mind, that you're better off using the lemon zest, because that won't split it. It will if you use loads, but not as it's not as tricky as the lemon juice. So again, just keep that in mind when you're putting in a lemon flavour to a dairy-based dish. Try and go for the zest over the juice.
You have another clever one now, to create your own buttermilk. How many times have we gone, I might make some soda bread and you've no buttermilk. You can create your own.
And it's just one of those amazing things. And the same, I rarely have buttermilk in the house. I do if I'm baking a recipe, but I never have it on hand. So it's always really handy for me where I just grab my full fat milk and just add a squeeze of lemon juice in there. So again, you're to get the best results, you're better to let your milk, full fat milk ideally, come up to room temperature. And again, you're only for about a liter of milk, you're just adding in about a tablespoon or so of lemon juice and just kind of stir that through and let it sit to one side for about half an hour. And it'll naturally split and it kind of gives that acidic property that you're looking for when you're making like a soda bread, because you want obviously that reaction between the bread soda and that nice lemon to get a rise in your bread. So again, just a little, I suppose, a tablespoon of lemon juice to a full fat milk at room temperature. And again, that will give you like an instant fast
You know, the buttermilk purists now will be listening, saying that that's just not going to cut it for them. But you're saying it works just as well, does it, Shane?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Like I said, it's not what I would say. It wouldn't be of the same quality, absolutely. But it definitely, if you're in a pickle and you just want to make something really fast, then it does get you out if you don't have time to run to the shop. It's definitely a fast hack to have.
Now, tell me about the fast, snappy dinners that the lemon gets involved in.
Yeah, again, I think the most simple dish I think that you can do with lemon is just a gorgeous buttery lemon pasta. So you're looking at, I suppose, butter is a great vessel for carrying flavour and it works really well with lemon. So if you're looking for a meal in minutes, what I always say is just throw on your pasta, whether that's your linguine, your spaghetti, fusilli, whatever it is that you have in the house. And in a pan, you're just kind of cooking down a little bit of onions, a little bit of butter, and then you can add in your lemon juice and zest. And then you're tossing your pasta in there and you can finish that off with a little bit of fresh herbs. And that's really light. It's really fast. Perfect coming into this time of year, more so the summer. It's a really light dish that's just beautiful paired with a little bit of bread on the side or a bit of green salad. And again, it is just kind of meals in minutes in a way.
Yeah,
it just works really well. And again, if you don't want to mix your butter, you can use like a rapeseed oil or an olive oil instead.
A squeeze of lemon on the greens, on the broccoli, you know, with your dinner and a little bit of butter. Can't go wrong there either.
Exactly. And that's even what I was just saying about the preserved lemons. If you wanted to try that out, that's another nice little touch too. If you just kind of chop up a little bit of even off that lemon zest and mix that through, because again, lemon just pairs so nice with, as you're saying there, broccoli and goat cheese and cream cheese. It pairs really well. So a lovely kind of even salad like that with some chopped nuts on the side. That is just almost a dinner in itself. It's really nice. And even just for your salads as well, what I always have in the fridge is a little jar of very simple dressing, just in my jam jar. And again, that is just your rapeseed oil, salt and pepper, and a little bit of mustard, depending on what kind of mustard you like, and then some lemon zest and juice in there. And basically that's just in your jar in the fridge, and just shake that up just before you serve your salad and just drizzle a little bit of that over it. And it's a really handy one to have again in the fridge. Just saves you 5 minutes or so, but it's a really, really nice kind of fresh, zesty dressing.
Why don't you just give me a paper cut and pour lemon juice on it? Chef Shane Smith extolling the virtues of lemons as a hero food on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. They're not just for your smoked salmon, you know. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE Radio Player. And there'll be another Playback Daily at the same time on Monday. But for me, until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.